Mishpatim. This is actually an interesting idea. So it was the summer of 1935. Settle down, children. It was the summer of 1935, and even after 2 years, they still didn't get it. Sometimes you just need a kick in the pants. Germany, if you know your history, actually went through a few different waves before they really got it together to start exterminating the Jewish people. Hitler came to power in 1933. Within a matter of months, the Nuremberg laws were passed, and they were they were confirmed, I think, in 1935. But there were, you know, I was at an askara for my wife's grandparents, and she did a little research, or my brother-in-law did, about where her grandfather was from. He was from Hanover, which was in Germany. And in Hanover, they started firing all the Jews in their jobs long before it became the law. In 1933, in the spring of 1933, not long after Hitler came to power, the largest department store in Hanover fired all of its Jewish employees. And this started happening. You know, people stopped shopping in Jewish stores. Jews had an easy time getting spit at, all sorts of little things that should have been warning bells, but they just weren't. And I met once a fellow. Whenever I meet a Holocaust survivor, there's certain questions I always want to ask. And if I can find the right opportunity, as long as I don't think I'm being offensive, I will ask this question. And one of them is, how did you get out? How did you survive? You meet people who, you could debate what a Holocaust survivor is, but I think somebody who got out right before the war and lost everything, they survived one aspect of the Holocaust. And it's fascinating to see what caused the penny to drop. What made a person realize it's time to get out? Unfortunately, most people, it was too late. It took them too long. But there were some people who got it. This particular fellow, he didn't get it until he got a kick in the pants. I believe, if I'm getting my dates right, it was the summer of 1935, and he was going to court. He had a court case. He was a landlord, his father was a landlord, they had a company, and they owned and leased properties. And there was a large department store in, I think it was in Berlin, but it doesn't really matter for the story. And they leased a building for this large department store. And the department store was in arrears. They weren't paying their rent. They were behind. And they had sent letters, and they had made phone calls, and they were just, you know, it just wasn't going anywhere. They were being ignored. The secretary was being rude. So they finally arranged an appointment, and they went with their paperwork, the contract, the bank statement, etc. And this wasn't the first time that this fellow had this kind of issue. It's a normal part of that business, that sometimes tenants will be in arrears, they have financial challenges, and eventually you have to go, and you have to threaten them with a lawsuit, and you have to show the paperwork, and you have to say, listen, and sometimes you have to settle, you owe me $1,000, I'll take $900 if you do it right now, and that sort of thing. And these people were experienced, and they knew what was coming, and they always succeeded in getting most of what they needed. And they went to this meeting, and the fellow who was the tenant sat with them, and he listened to everything they had to say, and he said, with a sort of sly grin, that's all fine, but I'm not paying you anything. And they said, why not? He said, because you're Jewish, and it's only a matter of time before we finally get rid of you. Now the proper party is in power, etc. You can imagine how this conversation went. And this fellow was dumbfounded. He just couldn't believe. Now, they still lived in the illusion that they had a court system and they had a legal system. And remember that in 1935, the Nazis were preparing for the Olympics. So they were gearing it up. They were trying to lower the volume on all their Jew hatred because this was going to be a showcase, you know, for the Nazis about how Germany is doing great things and all this talk about the Jews is nonsense and so on and so forth. But nonetheless, you know, a lot of anti-Jewish laws were already on the books. So they realized they were going to have to sue. So they sued. And 6 months later, in the summer of 1945, they found themselves in court. And they went to court, and this fellow, who actually asked me, for reasons I'm not quite sure, have asked me not to repeat his name, so we'll just call him, I don't know, David. So David gets to court, and he has a lawyer, I don't know, Chaim. And they're both two Jewish fellows. And one of them is quite obviously a Jewish fellow. That was his description. I didn't ask him what that meant. I don't know if that's because he was wearing a kippah, or he had a big nose, or he had a beard. I don't know what in his mind was obviously Jewish. But in other words, they knew that they were Jewish. You know, maybe his last name was Goldberg. Don't know. And they're standing before the judge. And mind you, they've been in this situation before. They have a lawyer. They have the court papers. They have the contract. Everything is there. And what was the defense of the defendant? They're Jews. And Jewish landlords charge exorbitant prices. And I'm not going to pay. Justice needs to be done. They should pay me. And this fellow starts laughing. Because that's ridiculous. You have a contract. And the judge listens to both sides of the court. Doesn't explain himself. Bangs on the gavel. And finds in favor of the defendant. And this fellow, David, is in shock. He can't believe it. There was no back and forth. There was no. They just found him right. He's out all his money in the court of law. So he gets up to say something, and the judge leans forward. And this fellow, standing at a Pesach bar many, many years later, said to me, he leaned forward, and he looked at me, and he had this expression, this derisive, cynical, condescending expression, looking at me as if he was talking to a child. And he says to me the following line, perhaps it's time for the Jewish landlord to leave Germany for the Germans. You should get out of Germany. You're no longer wanted here. Case closed. And in that moment, this fellow understood that he needs to get out. He did. He lost everything, but he got out. And what was remarkable to me was in telling this story to me, gosh, must have been 50, 60 years later, I could still see the pain in his eyes, the sting of it, the injustice of knowing you were right, and being told in a court of law that it just doesn't matter. This week's parsha is interesting. Because this week, we get down to the nitty-gritty. It's been all stories and revelation and plagues and massive events. They see sound. They hear God. The sea splits. But eventually, all the fanfare has to settle down. You have to finish the Nachal Kibbutzim tour. You have to finish the first Shabbos. You have to come down off the roof and all the dancing, come back up from the Kotel, and you got to sit down and you got to steig. You got to get to what it's all about. Ve'ele ha-mishpatim. This is the foundation. This is what it's all about. It's about the law. It's about being commanded. It's about rules that form the parameters of what a healthy society is supposed to be. There is a detail at the beginning of this week's parsha that's worth noting. It says, ve'ele ha-mishpatim. So Rashi takes note of this. The word ve is very distinctive, and it's very clear. Says Rashi, kol makom she'ne'amar ele. Whenever we refer to these, right? If it just says Eile HaMishpatim, Pasalet HaRishonim, it comes to exclude or differentiate from what came before it. Okay? Eile Divrei Moshe means these are the words of Moshe, and what came before it wasn't the words of Moshe. Right? Ve'eile, wherever you find that Vav, in this case, Vav HaChibur, the Vav of connection, or connecting, or combining, right? Mosif Ala Rishonim. It means that what is about to come is added to what preceded it. What are we talking about here? Ma rishonim misinai, af elu misinai. Just like the ones before came from Sinai. In other words, what are the ones before? The Aseret Dibrot. Just like the mitzvot in last week's portion, Parsha of Yitro, are from Sinai. Now what do we mean when we say they're from Sinai? What does that mean? Why is that important that they're from Sinai? What do you think? Just that they got given on a mountain?
The people that came in directly.
Oh, these are from Hashem. These are from Akash Baruch Hu. Ask me a question. Pardon? Are no mitzvot from Hashem. Ask me another question. Rashi says, just like these are from Sinai, he's actually quoting what? Just like these are from Sinai, right? So these two are from Sinai. This is a Medrash and Shmot Rabbi. Ask me a question. If I say it again, just like these that preceded it, that's why it says, and these. So just like what preceded it was from Sinai, these, what follows, is also from Sinai. Ask me a question. The Ten Commandments. Ask me a question.
They weren't given in the same way. Like one word, on the side of the other one, they're not.
Well, I wasn't thinking of that, but that's a good question. What then is the difference between the Aseret Dibrot, the Ten Commandments, and these? That's a good question. Ask me another question.
What's the purpose of that entire...
Pardon?
What's the purpose of that entire
dispute? Well, we'll get to that. No, much simpler, yeah?
What does it mean, from Sinai?
As opposed to?
From God.
Why does it just say that from God? Why does it say from Sinai? It's interesting. Okay. But it keeps going. V'lama nismecha parashat dinin leparashat nizbeach. Okay, so now we know that it's all from Hashem. It's all from Sinai. They're all part of the same Torah. Don't think that there's a part that's more important, part that's less important. Okay? But, lama nismecha parashat dinin leparashat nizbeach. The last topic with which we end last week's portion is actually a specific halacha. It's not about the Ten Commandments. Does anybody remember what the last mitzvah in Parsha Yitro is? Right? To build a mizbeach. Right? If you look at the end of Parsha Yitro, right? All of a sudden interrupts the narrative. Right? Lo tasu niti Elohei kesef Elohei zav lo tasu lachem mizbeach adamah taseh. You should make for me a mizbeach, an altar of earth. And you offer up your sacrifices on it. Your sheep, your cattle. Right? So you have to build an altar, and you should build it out of dirt. But if you build it out of rocks, you shouldn't build it gazit. What does gazit mean? Hewn. What's a hewn stone? Am I know? H-E-W-N? Cut by what? By iron. You shouldn't have an iron hewn. You shouldn't take a sword or a blades and cut out the rock. Rather, because if you cut a rock with iron or with steel in making a mizbeach, you have desecrated the rock. It can't be kodesh. It can't be holy. There's a whole discussion about what that is. We're not going to get into that now. But you can't use that stone for the mizbeach, for the altar. And you shouldn't have steps. You have to have a ramp because that's somehow modest. What's this doing here? What is this whole discussion? It's a few verses in between the Aseret HaDibrot and Parsha Mishpatim. Now, if Parsha Mishpatim, if our current portion was a whole different topic, then it wouldn't be a problem. But since the Vav, says Rashi, is connecting Mishpatim, the laws in Mishpatim, to the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, then what's this doing in the middle? Listen to what Rashi answers. Anybody know what he answers? Anybody know? First Rashi in the Parsha. Okay, got a little work to do, all right? So what does he say? He says, Lomar lecha, shetasim Sanhedrin etzel ha-mikdash. The Sanhedrin has to sit where the Beis HaMikdash is. That's what he says. First Rashi in the Parsha. Now this is interesting. The order of the Torah has changed. Hashem plans a specific topical conjunction so that we should know that the Sanhedrin has to sit next to the Mizbeach. What does it mean that the Sanhedrin has to sit next to the Mizbeach, next to the altar? So what does that mean? Anybody know where the Sanhedrin is meant to sit? Where was the Sanhedrin? Pardon? No, that's after the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. It went through 10 different places. That's true. It was in Sipori, it was in Yavne, a lot of different places. But where ideally was the temple? It sits next to the Beis Hamikdash. It's supposed to sit on Har HaBayit, on the Temple Mount. I know there's big discussions about that, but it actually is called the Temple Mount for a reason, right? And the Sanhedrin had a special chamber. Anybody know what the chamber was called? Pardon? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess so. Lishkata Gazit. Excellent, right? Lishkat HaGazit. It's called the Lishkat HaGazit. Why? Because it's the place where you hew stone. So isn't that interesting? The Mizbeach, the altar, you can't hew stone. But the Sanhedrin, you had a chamber of hewn stone. But they had to be next to each other. Now, if you broaden that topic, where does the Mizbeach sit? It's part of the Beis HaMikdash. The Sanhedrin has to sit next to the Beis HaMikdash. Why is that so important? Why does Sanhedrin have to be up on the Beis HaMikdash? So what do we have to do in order to figure this out? Everybody understand the question? Pardon? What do we have to define? What do we have to think about? What is the Beis HaMikdash? Like seriously, what was the point? By the way, eventually you're going to end up being asked this question. Somebody's going to answer this question. Three times a day you pray, which way do you face? You face Israel. Why do you face Israel? Well, actually, if you're in Israel, you face Jerusalem. Well, why aren't you doing face Jerusalem? You face that. What are you ultimately facing? You're facing the Makom HaMikdash. We dream of building a house, a temple. Why do you need a temple? Like, I have a friend who suggests that most of the problems we have in the Middle East are because too many people are too stuck on the concept of sacred space. It's just a mountain. It's just a piece of rock. Like, give it up, let them have it, who cares? You know? Why is that important? Why is so much of Judaism focused on building this place? Where is the first time we find actual mention in the Torah of the Beis HaMikdash? Anybody? Where did I first find mention of the temple? Where? Nope. Come on. Where's the first place that we find what's the pasuk? What's the verse? This is the first time you find mention of the Beit HaMikdash in the Torah. We say this every day. Okay? What does it say? Mikdash Hashem konanu yadecha. The temple of Hashem has been prepared by your hands. We were longing for, preparing for, a Beit HaMikdash already when the Egyptians were dead as soon as we got out of Egypt. Why do we need a Beis HaMikdash? And what does it have to do with the Sanhedrin? And why is that sitting here at the beginning of Mishpatim? So I want to suggest an idea. It's a simple idea. I didn't want to be complicated because I know a lot of guys getting up very little good chesbin, right? The Beit HaMikdash was much more than a building. It was supposed to represent something. And I'll give you an example that we've actually mentioned before, but it makes the point. There's an interesting halacha on Har HaBayit, okay, on the Temple Mount. Ein shvut b'mikdash. A shvut is a certain type of rabbinic decree. Okay? What's a good example? You don't play guitar. Right? Why don't you play guitar on Shabbat? Shema yitakin, because you might come to tune it or to fix it or if the string breaks. And that would be an isdoraisa, so that would be problematic, right? You can't be metaken kli, that's a tolad of bone maybe, right? So of building. So in order not to come to accidentally do something that's forbidden, so the rabbis made sort of an extra decree, and that's what a shvut is, right? It's designed to keep you safe, okay? Don't carry money, because if you have money, you might spend it, you might do something you're not supposed to do, and so on and so forth. But that does not apply in the Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't apply in the Har HaBayit. Why doesn't it apply in the Har HaBayit? In fact, I have this theory. When they build the Beis HaMikdash, the Kalbachers are going to go nuts. Because they're going to realize all of a sudden that on Shabbos, in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Chatzar, you can play guitar. Right? Now, you won't be able to play guitar on Shabbos here, because this isn't the Mikdash. So what do they have to do? You'll see thousands of people, Shkoyach, you'll see thousands of people running up the Har HaBayit with their guitars. It will be the greatest Shabbos morning jam session in the history of humanity. And I will be there. Okay? I'll total my guitar if I have to. It'll be unbelievable. In fact, if they build a Beis HaMikdash for that jam session, I'm buying a Gibson. It's going to be big. Right? Unbelievable. Right? Why? Why on Har HaBayit? By the way, when that happens, and all the Kalbachers are up there, and they're all getting ready to jam, don't worry, there'll be some guy in the back screaming, Shabbos! It's okay, right? But all right, right? Why is there no Shavuot B'Mikdash? This is actually not a complicated idea. I'll give you an example. Pick something in your mind that you struggle with. I don't know, let's say you fell into a bad habit and you use foul language sometimes when you shouldn't. Okay, that's a problem. Actually, is there the Rambam? We'll actually get that. The Rambam talks about it. But you want to stop it, but you're struggling with it. So you decide, right, that as a habit, right, when you talk, you're going to go like this. Because if you do this and put your hand on your mouth, maybe you'll remember not to curse. Okay. But then you have to go to an interview because you want to get into Gush. You want to go to Gush, start yeshiva. And you go to an interview. I remember when I had my interview of Lichtenstein. It was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. Fighting terrorists, interview of Lichtenstein. Not even close. Trust me, right? And you're sitting in front of Lichtenstein. You know, you take your hand down. Because if you were sitting in front of Lichtenstein, you would not be capable of cursing. You just wouldn't be capable of it. You would be so in awe of this personality, right? It's like if you have an anger issue, and you're struggling with anger, and you sometimes lose your temper. Some of you met Rav Nevinsel this week. He was here for the Bris. I challenge you to get angry in front of Rav Nevinsel. You couldn't do it. No matter what he would do to you, you couldn't get angry. You just couldn't do it. So if you were standing in Har HaBayit, the experience of being in the presence of such a place, that was the point of having a Beit HaMikdash, of having a temple, to create a space that was so intense, that was so awe-inspiring, that was so special, that was so holy, that you couldn't possibly make a mistake, right? On Shabbat, that falls on Rosh Hashanah, in the Beit HaMikdash, they will blow shofar. Because the reason the Talmud gives, some of us talked about this before, the reason the Gemara gives, lest you might carry, you would never do that. You're in the Beit HaMikdash. You could not possibly forget. In a makom mikdash, when fire is coming from the heavens and the showbread and the shulchan, it's unbelievable. So the Beit HaMikdash was meant to be a place of awe. It was meant to be a place that you could so experience the presence of Hashem in your life that it would have to impact you. That's why, by the way, three times a year, we're meant to be here. Because you need that battery recharge. You know, when you leave here one day after, you know, couple more years, when you leave here, right? So you can't take this place with you. Hopefully, you leave here different than when you got here. When you left the Beit HaMikdash at the end of Pesach, if you really had an experience, you shouldn't be the same person. It should be different. You know? Half the yeshiva next week is going to Poland. You walk out of Auschwitz at the end of the day, you are not the same person. The other half of the yeshiva, you're going to go to Atlit. That is an intense place. You're going to go to Akko. When you hear the story of what happened at Akko, you cannot go to that place and be the same person. You just can't. So three times a year, we came up to the Beit HaMikdash. And that was a place where you could feel the presence of Hashem. You could be in awe. And we need that in our lives. You know, when you go back to whatever it is you go back to, college, whatever it might be, know that you cannot experience what you experienced here, there. You can have a fantastic Kabbalat Shabbat. You can go to the hill at Maryland or Binghamton or wherever it is, and you can dance and you can sing, and it's beautiful and special. But you're not in the old city of Yerushalayim. And if the Sholosh Regalim, if the three festivals are an example, you got to get that battery charge. Right? You have to have a battery charge. And that battery charge is about reacquiring a sense of awe. That's what the Beit HaMikdash is. Now I can go back to this question. Right? So why does the Sanhedrin have to sit in the Makom Mikdash? Why does it have to sit right next to the Makom Mikdash? Why does it have to be right next to that place? What do you think? This is not so complicated. It's an opinion, but... Pardon?
They can't make a mistake.
What does it have to do with being based Mikdash? What do you mean?
Well, you said in the Beit HaMikdash, like, it's such a... It's a place where you wouldn't be able to make a mistake.
Okay, let's say for argument's sake, I'm not sure that we're talking about the judges. I think we're talking about the people who come to the court. But that is a legitimate question. In other words, what does a judge learn from that? But I don't think the Torah is speaking only to the judges. In any generation, there were 71 men who sat on the Sanhedrin. There were millions of Jews who came up on the other regular. I got to believe they're the principal target audience of this discussion. Anybody? Okay, we got some work to do. You all have to stay on a bet. That's it. Anybody? New? Oh, this is being recorded. Great. New? What do you think? Come on. Why does the Sanhedrin have to be next to such a place? Yeah?
Well, maybe it's like when you go there, like you really feel like the ruling is like from like this place. Like it's based off of like Hashem's word.
When you go to a court, to a bezdin, you need to be in a sense of awe. And the judges in that courtroom have to inspire that awe. That's the challenge with Beis Din. I want to tell you, this is fascinating halacha. The Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin. Where do we find Hilchos Sanhedrin? The laws of the Sanhedrin, the Rambam? Which book?
Shoftim.
Good. Shoftim. Okay, right? 13th book, right? Because that's the laws, all the laws of, you know, what comes from the Sanhedrin and whatever, right? Okay? So, Kol Hadan, listen to this. This is intense. This is the last halacha in Hilchos Shoftim. By the way, if you ever sort of decide if you're going to go through all the halachot, all the different books of the Rambam, one of the interesting things you can do, by the way, this is true from a portion of the week, portion of the Torah, take a look at the beginning, take a look at the end. The bookends of a topic usually speak volumes about what it's all about. That's true in every portion of the Torah. Babaji Rebbe talks about this at length. It's true in the Rambam. The Rambam chooses very carefully how he starts and how he finishes. He is a master organizer. What is the last halacha? At the end of the 26th chapter of Hilchos Sanhedrin. By the way, how many mitzvot are there in Hilchos Sanhedrin? This is fascinating. 30 mitzvot. There are 30 different mitzvot. Out of 613, 30 different mitzvot that relate to the Sanhedrin. Right? Which means, since we don't have a Sanhedrin today, you're now down to about 580 that you got to work on. That's not bad. Okay. Anyway, what's your discount? Kol Hadan. This is Perek Vav Halacha Zayin, seventh halacha, last halacha in the book of Judges, in Sefer Shoftim, of the Rambam. Kol Hadan, b'dayne aku, u'be'ercha ot shalahem. Anybody who judges or is judged, who uses the court system of the non-Jewish world and their values, okay? In other words, if I think Seth Silverman owes me $50, and he won't pay it, I say, okay, I'm taking you to Beis Din. If I go to a civil court instead of going to a Beis Din, okay? Afal pi shayu dinehem kedinei Yisrael, even if their laws are the same as our laws. In other words, you know, if you're an American civil court, there are a lot of topics where we hold the same thing, right? The testimony, you know, if a person signed a contract, the question is, what was the meaning of the contract? Like, it's not that different, right? Harei zeh rasha. Such a person is wicked. That's a really powerful statement. In other words, the Rambam Paskins, this is based on the Gemara, you're not allowed to go to a civil court. You have to go to a Beis Din. People don't know this. Uki'ilu charaf ve'gadaf ve'rim yad b'torat Moshe Rabbeinu. It's like a person blasphemed or raised his hand against the Torah. Shneemar quotes a pasuk. Want to guess which pasuk he quotes? Shneemar ve'eile ha'mishpatim. Asher tasim lifnehem. These are the laws that you will put before them, right? Lifnehem below lifnei akum. You have to put the laws before it. The judges have to be given these laws, and you have to go to a Beis Din, right? That's a fascinating halacha. Why do you need to go to a Beis Din? It's very simple. Because court isn't just about finding out whether you get the money. Court was meant to be an opportunity to experience Hashem in your life. To see Torah living. The dayanim in a court had to be inspirational role models. They had to inspire you to a different level of behavior. Right? If you went to a Beis Din in the old Welt and you were sitting with the Chaim Ozer Gudinsky and the Chafetz Chaim, and you have a chance to stand in front of people who are Bucky and Olav Shas and Poskim. By the way, in addition, and the Rambam is going to say this. Let me see if I can find this halacha. In Perek Aleph, halacha hey, what does the Rambam say? You know, I'll read you three halachot just to make this point, and then we'll. So the Rambam says like this. This is in halacha gimel, the first perek. Kama batei dinim kovin betchila beit din agadol b'migdash. The first thing that you do when we reestablish sort of the system of courts in batei dinim as it's meant to be, Shia comes whatever, is. You don't start with little courts. You start with this Beis Din HaGadol, the Sanhedrin. Bamikdash. Has to be the Beis HaMikdash. He doesn't say the Mizbeach. He understands that it's a euphemism for the Beis HaMikdash. Right? For who any cross and Hedri Gedola, Minyanem Shim Machad. And that court that has to be the Beis HaMikdash, where we start from, is the 71 members of the Sanhedrin. Now, listen to this. How does he define the 71? And you tell me in a minute why I'm reading this to you. Ready? Okay? Tell me why I'm reading this to you. Hagadol bechokhma shebekulan moshivin oto rosh alehen vuhu rosh hayeshiva vuhu shekorin oto hachachamim nasi bechol makom vuhu haomed tachat Moshe Rabbeinu. Who is the person who gets appointed to be the head of the Sanhedrin? Hagadol mikulam bechokhma. What does that mean?
It's
a balanced person. Has to be a healthy person. Has to be a role model. Has to be a vehicle for ethics. That's what law is supposed to be. It's supposed to engender enough. Look at, listen to Allah. Hey, kol ir she'ein ba shnei chachamim gdolim. Now, anybody who hasn't studied Hilchot Deot, the Rambam is consistent with his terminology, won't understand this. He'll misunderstand this, right? If a city does not have two great chachamim, two healthy, balanced people, echad ra'oi l'lamed u'larot, one of them has to be worthy of teaching, has to be bucking all shas, etc. B'chol ha'Torah kula, he has to know all of Torah. V'echad yodeh lishmo, v'yodeh lishol u'lashiv. He knows how to talk to people. He knows how to understand your pain. He knows how to communicate with you. Right? Ein moshivin b'sanhedrin. If you don't have these two guys, you don't have a sanhedrin. That city cannot hold a sanhedrin. Right? So what Rashi is really saying here, essentially, right, is that the Sanhedrin has to sit next to the Beis HaMikdash because it has to be a Mikdash Me'at. It has to be the same experience as the Beis HaMikdash. And that leaves me with one final point. Because if that's what the Beit HaMikdash is, and that's what law is supposed to be, and by the way, it's an aside, but how far we've come from that. How far we've come from that. Without it getting into politics, you know, do we trust the court systems? Are our judges our role models? Are they people we want to emulate? That's the way it was meant to be. Is that the way it is? And by the way, I would go so far as to say, you know, I have a friend, someone I'm close with, who works with the Batei Dinim. Far be it from me to judge Talmidei Chachamim, but even if it's just in perception, there is a serious challenge with the way the public views Batei Dinim, halakhic Batei Dinim in Israel. Right? And the things that have happened over the last 40, 50 years that have undermined the image of a dayan, of a towering Torah scholar, as being a chacham, as being a healthy, balanced person. And whether, when you walk into a court, you're in awe of the role model sitting before you. Right? And just to finish this off, if that's what a Beis HaMikdash is, and if that's why the Sanhedrin has to sit next to the Beis HaMikdash, then by association, that's what every place that we call a Mikdash Me'at is supposed to be. The Gemara calls a Beit Midrash a Mikdash Me'at. It's supposed to be reminding us of the Beis HaMikdash. Right? When the Beit Midrash was destroyed and the center of Judaism went up in flames, Chazal had this tremendous challenge. Right? Certainly, we know it's less apparent to us after Bayit Rishon because for all sorts of reasons. But certainly after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, they had a dilemma. They didn't know what to do. We've lost the center of Judaism. What do? They had to find a way to replicate what was lost so that we wouldn't lose it. And there are two places that are meant to replicate the Beit HaMikdash. What are they? It's first, Beit Midrash / Beit Knesset. Just to give you one example, look around the room, find me something that is meant to remind us of the Beis HaMikdash. You have a Ner Tamid, and you have an Aron. Right? Very simple. What about a place that has many more reminders of the Beis HaMikdash? And when do I experience that place?
Shabbos.
You come to my house on Shabbos, we smell Besamim on Friday night. If you go down to the Kotel, right? So, did you see actually there was a guy giving them out Friday night as we were dancing out? Did you see? They give out Isvei B'Samim. Why do they give out Isvei B'Samim Friday night? What is that supposed to remind us of? The Ketoret. Why do we have a Shabbos candles? Remind us of the Ner Tamid. We eat Shabbos at the table. Why? Because it's reminding us of the Shulchan. We put salt on the bread. Why? Because it reminds us of the Mizbeach, the Korbanot. Right? We have two chalot. If you go to an old-time bakery, this is really interesting. If you go to an old-time bakery, my wife had a good friend when she was like first in Israel many, many years ago, whose father was a baker. And I found this out. This fascinated me. The old Yerushalmi bakers, they make a challah. You know, they take like, they make like strips of dough, and then they you know what I'm saying? They weave them to make a challah. That's what a challah is. How many strips of dough are in each one of those challahs? Anybody know? Six in each one. Why? What does that end up with? 12. What does that remind you of? The lechem apanim. There were 12 loaves in the lechem apanim. That's what that minhag is from. So, if that's what a Beis HaMikdash is, and that's what a Mikdash Me'at is, then that also is supposed to be a place where we experience Hashem in our lives, where we experience a certain sense of awe. There aren't that many places in this world you can feel that. And it's a partnership. It's about creating that. It's about deciding that your Shabbat table and your home and the place where you learn Torah. If you're in a place where there is no environment where you can feel a certain sense of Hashem in that place, a certain sense of awe, then you're in the wrong place. Very simple. You don't build a Sanhedrin in that place. Very simple. That's something to think about. So there's a lot more to talk about. We'll stop here. Let me just...